More than 500,000 Americans are currently experiencing homelessness. When the COVID-19 pandemic hit, millions of people lost their jobs, prompting the federal government to place a moratorium on evictions. But that was a short-term moratorium that really didn't do enough to address the crisis. Or did it? And what happens next now that those protections are nearly all gone? Joining me to discuss this are Rob Robinson, member of the Campaign to Restore National Housing Rights, and Beth Mellon, the director of Legal Aid's Eviction Defense Project. Thank you both for joining me. Beth, I'm going to start with you. When the federal moratorium on evictions ended on August 26th of last year, many people predicted that we would see a so-called eviction tsunami. But so far, much of the data indicates that didn't happen. Why?
I think the main reason we're seeing this in the District of Columbia is that the federal government came in with hundreds of millions of dollars of rental assistance. And so that helped. In D.C., we've had about $400 million in rental assistance distributed to landlords on behalf of tenants. And so it may have just kind of held off on a tsunami that's gradually going to come. Maybe it's not going to be a tsunami, but it's going to play out over time. But that money has made a huge difference.
Wow, that's actually encouraging news. Rob, despite the fact that the data at least seems somewhat encouraging, the fact remains that in six states, 31 cities, the organization Eviction Lab tracks those places, and more than 8,000 people have been evicted in the past week alone. Does the perception that the tsunami never happened make the work of advocating for housing rights actually more difficult?
I think it does. I agree with Beth that there was federal money to sort of slow that tsunami, but I think certain states play out different. We've had stronger protections in New York, which ended January 15, 2022. Our protections in New York were stronger than the federal protections. However, we just had a protest in front of Bronx Housing Court in New York because there are 20,000 cases in the hopper ready to be activated and start evicting people, you know, in Bronx, New York. But I think in other places around the country, similar is going to happen. We will see, once the courts open up, we will see a rush to evict.
Speaking of courts, Beth, when the Supreme Court blocked an extension on the eviction moratorium, many understandably responded in protest. But the court said if the moratorium was going to continue, it had to come from Congress. Does the court have a point? It doesn't seem unreasonable to many that Congress should be making the laws. I mean, that is the legislative branch. Again, should we be putting some pressure on Congress for this?
So sure, of course, we should be pressuring Congress to act. But Congress has made the laws. So Congress has passed laws that say the Center for Disease Control and Prevention has certain authority to act, including in an emergency. Congress has made laws about the healthcare system and healthcare workers, you know, being vaccinated and those kinds of things. And so the point is Congress has acted and said, we have this huge nation, we have all of these different actors trying to protect health. And we are going to give agencies some authority to act when they need to quickly on the ground, knowing what's happening on the ground.
Beth, but what do you do with those who do end up in court? As one judge put it, it's pretty clear who could do something about this problem. The courts don't make the laws. You're the director of the Legal AIDS Eviction Defense Project. You represent clients for landlord-tenant issues in Washington, D.C., right here where we are. Are there ways to protect tenants in courts that don't necessarily require legislative reform?
Absolutely. And our court in D.C. has done some of these things, so I'll mention a few things. So before the pandemic, landlord-tenant court in D.C., you would have 150, 200 tenants showing up in the morning at 9, 10 a.m. They're there for the whole day, missing work, having to deal with child care. And some tenants just didn't come because of those issues. Also, tenants didn't have to be served court papers till a week before their court date. So Imagine you know that you have to go to court in a week. You have to make all these arrangements. You may not be able to do it. So our city council has changed the law. So you have to get 30 days notice before the first court hearing. But what the court has been doing is scheduling hearings in 1-hour blocks. And so, you know, that's your hour. The court has allowed proceedings to be remote and really is committed to continuing to allow that. So if you need to be at home and come to court, if it's just kind of a status hearing or something where there's not going to be testimony, there's not going to be a trial, you can do that from your home.
So I don't necessarily have to choose between, for example, child care.
Exactly.
And going to court and protecting my home.
Exactly.
One landlord in New York City could barely make ends meet, and I'm just giving you as an example, and she worried that she might lose her family home after her tenants stopped paying rent. It left her short $70,000. To cope with the loss of income as a result of the eviction moratorium, some local landlords are selling their property to institutional investors. Many worry that this will only mean higher rents and fewer options for the very people the moratorium, the eviction moratorium, was supposed to help. Does support for local landlords need to be a bigger part of the conversation?
It definitely needs to be a bigger part. And I think the movement, the Right to Counsel Coalition and Housing Justice for All, have made that clear in New York City and New York State. That is their part of their struggle. They support the small landlords. What they are arguing against is the bigger landlords who use eviction court as a factory to mass produce evictions, because we have things like rent control in New York. If I can get the tenant out, and some places keep it empty for 2 years in New York, rent control goes away. Then I bring it back as a market rent apartment, right? So we need to preserve, you know, those rent controlled apartments. So I do think the movements in New York, the social justice, the grassroots community support those small landlords. But we also need to get a wake up call from our elected officials. The other thing I want to just add to, I think Beth makes a significant point about the number of cases in a particular courtroom. If a judge, and this is not unusual in New York, has 100 eviction cases on a docket on a given day, it's going to be mass production, man. I'm going to get these cases off my desk as fast as possible. And that's part of the problem. I agree. We need to slow that process significantly.
Slow the process down, but also, again, focus on these local landlords. There was a survey done, and it showed that 23% of small landlords owning between one and three single-family homes plan to sell at least one property due to the difficulties caused by the eviction ban. And again, they're not selling to other small landlords, right? They're selling to big companies who can afford to wait out the game or to just take whatever hits in order to raise the rent and push other people out. What do we do?
So rental assistance, I think, has been a big part of writing this. I think small landlords potentially should be looked at differently. I will say small landlords, however, I think something we have to keep in mind, they are the ones we often see in the district who are having tenants living in terrible conditions. They are threatening tenants. They are doing things that are illegal. They are locking tenants out. And so I think it's really important to have that full picture that
small romanticize the small local landlord either.
And there are two sides to that issue because, look, you know, small businesses are a form of wealth creation, so forth, in communities and for people of color, and we need to have that full picture. But I think it's important to keep in mind there's another side to that story. And so in D.C., we have a small landlord lobby, and they actually have been kind of the most vocal, the most vitriolic in fighting against any protections for tenants. And so it's just important to keep all these things in balance, look at the picture overall when we try to come up with solutions.
That's an important point, right? Because I think we would all agree insecure housing is a problem. Even people on the extremes of each political party would say, yeah, unhoused people is not a good thing.
That's the
right. Problem is agreeing on a solution to this problem.
That's right.
That's where you go. And it was a subject, for example, used by Donald Trump to blame Democrats, right? But it's also something that's divisive in the Democratic Party. Also, it doesn't seem like the people who we're hearing from the most are the people who are catching the most pain from this, right? People who are actually experiencing housing insecurity.
Right.
So talk to me about what we're getting wrong.
And again, you
speak as someone formerly unhoused.
What from
your own experience has shaped how you understand this? In addition to being in the shelter and understanding the shelter system, what else?
Being brought to the table and my voice mattering, right? Have a voice in the decision-making policy. The problem is you tend to romanticize that individual voice. You need more voices like mine and others to come to the table.
What kind of voice gets romanticized, though? Is the person that pulls them up by the bootstrap? Is the person
who... So here's Rob, right? So Rob came from a family, right? He was once living in, you know, middle-class America, right? Family, stable family. He went homeless for 2.5 years, spent 10 months in the shelter, found his way out. Anybody can do it. No, not anybody can do it, right? I had an infrastructure around me. I had knowledge of how it was to live non-homeless. Many of the folks who were suffering had lived in poverty and struggled all their lives. So they need help. You can't just pick yourself up by your bootstraps. You need support. Right? And your voice needs to be heard and your voice needs to matter. So when you make those decisions, when you're in front of a politician who's signing off on legislation, who knows nothing about homelessness, doesn't make any sense to me. I once said to Mayor Bloomberg in New York, as I was brought to a table with 30 individuals who were going to address the housing problem in New York, and I asked him before it started, Mayor Bloomberg, did you ever sleep on a piece of cardboard? He looked at me bemused. I asked him again. He says, I don't understand what you mean. I said, what I mean is you have a bunch of people around this table who never went through this issue, but they're making decisions about it. The meeting ended abruptly. When the meeting was brought back 6 months later, the table was divided 50-50. 50 with decision makers, 50 with people with lived experience. Wow. So those voices have to be brought to the table. They have to matter, and they have to be part of that decision-making process.
Beth, Rob, thank you so much for joining me on Upfront.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Everybody, that is our show. Upfront, we'll be back next week.